Al Unser, the winner of the 1970 Indianapolis 500.
Al Unser, winner of the 1971 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Johnny Lightning Carr still the quickest so far.
Checkered flag for Mark Donahue.
Paul Lotta-Cock, Einhopper, and Roger Penske.
Gordon John Cox still holding on to first place.
Yellow flag is out, perhaps just slowing down for race.
I really hate to see a race end this way. I would surely like to win the 500 miles.
And here's the checkered flag for Johnny Rutherford.
Here comes the rain.
Bobby Unser may have weathered the storm.
Johnny Rutherford doesn't care which lap he leads as long as it's the last one. Lap number 102.
We're here at the crossroads of America. Goodbye.
May 2nd, Sid Collins passed away.
This broadcast crew deeply feels the loss of our leader, Sid Collins.
In company with the first lady ever, gentlemen, start your engine.
A.J. Foyt has won his fourth 500-mile race. Al Unser, the winner of the 1978 500-mile race. Brett Mears, the winner of the 63rd 500-mile race.
This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. In this episode, we'll look back at some of the headlines from the 1970s. We'll look back at a tragedy-riddled race that sparked some safety improvements. We'll profile a fan favorite who visited Victory Lane twice in the decade. And we'll highlight the celebrities who have graced the Speedway grounds. But first, we check out the on-track action during the 70s. While the 60s saw major changes at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the 70s saw no less groundbreaking. Innovations, particularly in aerodynamics, allow speeds to skyrocket. At the start of the decade, the track record is 171.559 miles an hour. The 70s sees the 200-mile-an-hour barrier fall. Social change is also evident at 16th and Georgetown. Before 1971, women are not allowed in Gasoline Alley. At the end of the decade, Janet Guthrie is a veteran of three 500-mile races. In 1970, the run for the pole becomes a three-way battle. A.J. Foyt sets the standard early before Al Unser claims the top spot. Later in the afternoon, Johnny Rutherford turns in a four-lap average that falls 1/100th of a mile an hour short of Big Al's average. That margin stands as the smallest in 500 history for 42 years. The race isn't nearly as competitive. Unser takes command at the start and is rarely challenged.
A handsome man from Albuquerque, the blue number two, and he got quite a hand up here. The crowd rose as one when he came by, and that's a great tribute to a great driver with a great car. And now here is Sid.
Al Unser, the checkered flag, the winner of the 1970 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Big Al leads 190 of the 200 laps. Mark Donahue finishes second, 32 seconds back. In 1971, Unser isn't quite as dominant. Instead of sitting on the pole, he starts fifth. Instead of leading 190 laps, he only leads 103. Instead of winning by 32 seconds, he wins by a mere 22.
Blue car with a big number one, and he is number one. And now to call the winner for the 24th consecutive time is our chief announcer, the voice of the 500, Sid Collins.
And here is Pat Vidan waving the checkered flag for Al Unser, winner of the 1971 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Unser joins Wilbur Shaw, Maury Rose, and Bill Vukovic as back-to-back winners. Nobody will duplicate the feat until Elio Castroneves three decades later. During the 1971 time trials, the 1 and 4 lap record speeds are bettered by roughly 7 miles an hour. In 1972, Tom Carnegie has more new track records to announce on the public address system as USAC allows larger bolt-on rear wings. Bobby Unser's pole-winning speed is over 194 miles an hour, a 17-mile-an-hour increase over Peter Revson's record-setting pace from the previous year. Race day isn't nearly as kind to Uncle Bobby. He drops out early, as does Revson, who started second. Gary Bettenhausen shows the way for 138 laps before his engine goes south. Looks like Jerry Grant's race to win before he's forced to pit on lap 188.
Jerry Grant has just come into the pit area for an unscheduled, unexpected pit stop. Lou Palmer, are you near him? Apparently not, so we'll watch him from here. He's back, being pushed back out again, and there he goes as Mark Donahue goes by.
Donahue leads only 13 laps, but they're the last 13. Also visiting Victory Lane for the first time is Donahue's car owner, Roger Penske, who will become quite familiar with that piece of real estate. May of 1973 turns out to be a month everybody associated with the Speedway would love to forget. The proceedings begin ominously when veteran driver Art Pollard is killed in a crash during pole day practice. Johnny Rutherford wins the pole, turning in a lap that falls just short of the magic 200-mile-an-hour barrier. That's the good news for the month. On race day, rain delays the start by 4 hours. When the green flag finally waves, a lap one crash seriously injures driver Salt Walther, hurts 11 spectators, and damages 12 cars. The rain returns during the cleanup, postponing the race to the next day. Rain again washes the event out on day two. It's the first time the race has to be postponed 2 days in a row. After another 3 hour rain delay on the third day, the race finally starts. On lap 58, Swede Savage slams into the inside wall in turn four, and his car bursts into flames. He suffers severe burns and internal injuries. In the immediate aftermath, a fire truck going through pit lane strikes and kills a crew member from the STP team. Gordon Johncock is the leader when the race is stopped because of more rain on lap 133. There is no victory banquet to celebrate Johncock's win. Savage succumbs to his injuries a month later. In 10 starts prior to the 1974 500, Johnny Rutherford had never led a lap. Despite posting the second quickest qualifying speed of the month, JR qualifies on day two of time trials and therefore starts 25th. He has little trouble moving toward the front on race day. He battles A.J. Foyt through much of the middle portion of the race. Foyt's car begins leaking oil and is black flagged on lap 139. Rutherford inherits the lead and never looks back.
Handsome driver, winning smile, and Johnny Rutherford. And here to call the winner is the voice of the 500, Sid Collins.
And here's the checkered flag for Johnny Rutherford, winner of the 1974 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Rutherford leads 122 laps en route to the first of his three 500 victories. In 1975, A.J. Foyt adds to an ever-growing list of milestones. He sits on the pole for the fourth time, tying Rex Mays' all-time record. A.J. falls behind Gordon Johncock until Johncock's transmission breaks 9 laps into the race. Foyt takes command until lap 59 when Wally Dallenbach grabs the lead. It looks like Dallenbach's day until he drops out with a burned piston on lap 162. Meanwhile, a scary moment occurs on lap 126.
Coming off the second turn, Tom Sneba spun, got into the outside wall. The car has come to stop just in front of us. There was some flame. The engine's torn completely off of the car. He was stunned, flipping around in the car. It got airborne, hit the wall, came to light right side up, right here in front of us. We're looking right down on it right at this moment. The fire department is there. They've got fuel on the car, a fire extinguisher stuff on the car. Tom, they're helping him out of the car. He is moving around. Let's see. They have the fire put out now.
Sneva walks away with burns to his hands, face, and legs. After Dallenbach's exit, Johnny Rutherford and Bobby Unser swap the lead. Unser is in front on lap 174 when a sudden downpour signals an early end of the race. Bobby joins his brother Al as a two-time 500 winner. The 1976 500 turns into a duel between a couple of wily Texans, A.J. Foyt and Johnny Rutherford. JR takes the lead for good on lap 80 when A.J. slows. For the third time in 4 years, Mother Nature refuses to permit a full 500-mile race. The race is stopped on lap 103, making it the shortest one in history. Fortunately, it is 28 years before another Indianapolis 500 had to be cut short. May 1977 proves to be an historic month for several reasons. For the first time since the creation of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network 25 years earlier, somebody other than legendary Sid Collins will serve as the radio voice of the 500. Collins dies on May 2nd. His hand-picked successor, Paul Page, becomes the new anchor. During time trials, Sneva becomes the first to break the 200-mile-an-hour barrier. Janet Guthrie makes the race, breaking the gender barrier. The race develops into a duel between A.J. Foyt and Gordon Johncock. On lap 184, Johncock's engine expires, giving the lead to A.J. Foyt. Foyt is on his way to making more history.
A.J. Foyt down the main straightaway. The checkered flag is out. A.J.'s hand in the air. He is the winner. A.J. Foyt at Indianapolis has won his fourth 500-mile race.
Foyt becomes the charter member of the four-time Winners Club. The 1977 race also turns out to be the last for Tony Holman. The Speedway savior passes away later that year at the age of 76. 1 year after Foyt creates the four-time Winners Club, there is a new three-time winner crowned. Tom Sneva breaks his own track record from the year before and again sits on the pole. But Al Unser has the dominant car during the race. Big Al is in command until his final stop on lap 180. He overshoots his pit and hits a tire, bending his front wing. Unser has to slow down for the final 20 laps and hope he has enough of a cushion to hold off Sneva.
Doing a fantastic job is Al Unser. The checkered flag is waved. His hand is in the air. Al Unser, the winner of the 1978 500-mile race.
The final margin of 8.09 seconds is the second closest in 500 history to that point. In the offseason between 1978 and 79, several prominent car owners form a new organization, Championship Auto Racing Teams. CART runs a competing series to the 500 sanctioning body, the United States Auto Club. USAC bars six CART owners from entering their cars in the 1979 500. Those owners go to court and are granted an injunction, meaning they can take part in the month of May after all. Some more squabbling over rules leads to two cars being added to the starting grid, bringing the total to 35 instead of the traditional 33. On the track, rising star Rick Mears thwarts Tom Sneva's bid for a third straight pole. Al Unser leads for much of the first half of the race before developing mechanical problems. Brother Bobby takes over and controls the second half until his transmission begins to give out. Mears takes the lead on lap 182 and is on his way to a win.
And the checkered flag is given to Rick Mears of Bakersfield, California. His hand in the air acknowledging victory. Rick Mears, the winner of the 63rd 500-mile race.
It takes Mears just two Indianapolis 500 starts to find the way to victory lane. The Rockets' stock will continue to rise through the 1980s. Up next, the 1973 500, not remembered fondly because of several serious injuries and fatalities. It did give rise to some changes with safety in mind. This is the history of the 500. This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. It's the one race everyone wants to forget. The 1973 Indianapolis 500 has gone down in history as one of the most disastrous months of May ever. Speedway historian Donald Davidson says the dismal month started with the dreary weather, which hampered the entire slate of activities.
It just seemed like every day, because I was working for USAC at that time, and I can remember just sort of looking out the front door and just seeing, you know, not only dark skies, but, you know, white clouds in front of the dark skies and going in opposite directions. And I thought, good Lord, it looks like there's going to be a tornado. And it just seemed like it was every day like that.
Pole day was marred by a crash that took the life of the very popular Art Pollard in the morning practice session.
Art Pollard, horrendous accident with one of the most popular guys, if not the best known, you know, internationally, certainly within the sport and locally, a very, very popular guy mysterious accident. I don't know that anybody today really knows what happened there.
Later that same day, Johnny Rutherford won the pole with new 1- and 4-lap track records. The new 1-lap record JR set was just over 199 miles an hour. Just 2 years earlier, the record stood at only 174. It was the only real highlight of the month. Speeds were climbing in part due to the giant rear wings, which had only just become legal.
The cars had changed so much with the wings coming out and it being permissible in 72. And so the speeds had skyrocketed. You know, we'd been at right at 170 in 1970, and now we're looking at 200.
Race day was scheduled for Monday, May 28th. The start of the race was delayed by rain, and the event finally got underway at 3 o'clock. At the start, disaster.
We have a tremendous crash here going into the number one turn in the back of the pack, Mike. We'll take it back here once again. The red flag is out. The red flag is out. We'll not try to guess how many cars. Near the very back of the pack, something happened.
In all, 12 cars were involved in the crash, which sent burning fuel into the grandstand when Salt Walther's car hit the catch fence. 11 spectators were injured. The race was red flagged. During the delay, while emergency crews tended to the injured and repairs were made to the fence, rain returned to the brickyard, and the race was postponed to the following day. Tuesday dawned with more rain in the morning, delaying the start again. After the second command of gentlemen, start your engines, the drivers got in two parade laps before the rain began to fall again. It never let up, and the race was postponed to Wednesday. The weather on Wednesday started out no better. Rain continued to plague the event, and it looked like another postponement was inevitable. But suddenly, the sun came out, and just after 2 p.m., The race was on.
Here they come down the main stretch, the world's fastest flying start. The green flag is waved, and the 1973 Indianapolis 500-mile race is on. Mike Ahern.
Yes, Sid, and it's a replay of Monday up front. Bobby Unser pitches them off at the head. Then it's Mark Donohue, and then it's Mario Andretti. Johnny Rutherford has dropped the fourth.
The race fell into a typical pattern with early attrition until disaster struck again on lap 58.
Mark Donohue, meanwhile, is going very, very slowly, and I think you may have...
We have a crash on the fourth turn. Jim, can you see it? The yellow is out. Jim Shelton.
It was a violent crash with much flame, but it's way down the track from me, Sid. I cannot see really who it is.
The red flag is out, and the race is being stopped. The red flag is out, and the race is being stopped.
Popular driver Swede Savage had just come out of the pits when he had one of the worst accidents in Speedway history. In fact, the damage from the crash was so devastating that it was initially believed additional cars had to have been involved. Savage was a driver on the Pat Patrick Racing Team, which also included Gordon Johncock and Graham McRae. After the crash, one of McRae's crew members, Armando Turan, ran out onto pit road toward the crash site and was hit by a fire truck racing to the scene. The accident happened in front of thousands of spectators and live on the Speedway's radio network.
And unfortunately, after 59 laps, after a beautiful start and a smooth running race, it is being stopped, has been stopped. And we have fire all the way across. And a man was hit here by an official fire truck. He's directly in front of us, trying to go up the pit area, around the track. And a man was hit. We're not going to try to decide who it was as yet.
By this time, even the unflappable Sid Collins seemed to be ready for the month to be over.
Oh, this has been one of the most disastrous months of May all the way around. Getting the race underway, getting it started, having a first lap accident yesterday on Monday. Unable to start yesterday because of bad weather. Now we've had a man in the pit being hit by an official fire truck. And we have fire being put out as the race is stopped in the north end.
Armando Turan died later that afternoon. Swede Savage would die in July. After another hour delay, the race resumed, but rain would once again intervene, this time ending the event.
Yeah, they've been Marlon Fenglich, chief steward, says it is the end of the race. So there's something else new this time, Don, you can put in the file. We had the end of the race, and no checkered flag was even waved. No checkered flag was actually waved. I did see Pat Vidan reach out and take his black and white checkered umbrella and put it up.
Gordon Johncock was declared the winner at lap 133. There was no victory banquet. His celebration consisted of a visit to Methodist Hospital to check on teammate Swede Savage and a dinner at a local fast food restaurant. Donald Davidson.
Poor Johncock was in victory lane, but Swede Savage was his teammate. And so the victory banquet had been canceled because it had been pushed from Monday night to Tuesday night, and now the race is on Wednesday. And so the crew went down to Methodist Hospital to check on Savage, and on the way back they realized that they were hungry, and they stopped at a little place. The building's still there, but it's not a restaurant anymore. And it was just like a little Greasy Spoon diner on 16th Street that Johncock and his lady and Pat Patrick and his wife and maybe some other crew members had their victory dinner in this little place. And Gordy went home and he said, for days, weeks thereafter, that nothing much happened. And then, in August, they sort of started to, people would call up and they'd start to get notes, and people said, you know what? After all, you did win it. It is going to be your face on the Borgona Trophy, and thank goodness his, as tarnished as that victory may be, if it is in fact tarnished, the payback was when he won the race in 82.
The aftermath of the 1973 500 brought sweeping changes.
As far as the cars were concerned, they downsized the onboard fuel from 75 gallons to 40. And then also for a while, fuel could only be carried on the right-hand side, so the new cars didn't have left-hand tanks, and the existing cars could still run, but they had to fill the tanks with sponge rubber or something. The main straightaway wall was raised, 18 inches or 2 feet, I think. The pit wall was also raised. They extended where you would come in the pits. It used to be you'd come out of turn 4 down the straightaway for quite a while before you could go over to where the pit lane started. It was quite a way down the straightaway. They extended that so that you would enter much further north, not where you do now. You couldn't come through turn four and, you know, already be on the pit lane. You'd still have to come through four, but it was extended. And I think the idea was to make each individual pit larger, I think. There was a wall that ran at an angle that Savage hit, and that came out. And then all of the fold-up seats, I mean, I can't imagine why anybody would want to sit there anyway, because I'm sure in the 20s and 30s that were okay, but at 200 miles an hour, it was a lousy seat. So all the fold-up chairs down on the grass, they were gone. So the first row of the grandstands was quite a way back from the track.
And smaller rear wings were mandated as well.
Not only had they become large, I mean, from the time that wings were allowed, because they weren't, I mean, the rule, any aerodynamic device had to be an integral part of the body. Well, McLaren found a way around that. So when bolt-on rear wings were first allowed, were 72, and they were massive, just massive. And so they went through the 72 season like that, and then up through Indianapolis in 73, and then immediately they cut them. Now, I think at Milwaukee they would still be the big ones, but for Pocono on, they would downsize considerably. So if you look at a 74 wing at the Speedway versus a 70, 72, 73 wing, it's considerably smaller.
Beginning in 1974, the race would be scheduled for the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, making Memorial Day itself a rain date if necessary. Up next, we profile one of the most successful and most popular drivers in Indy 500 history, Johnny Rutherford. This is the history of the 500. This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. As much as any driver who'd ever raced in the Indianapolis 500, Johnny Rutherford qualifies as a Renaissance man. He's an accomplished artist, a pilot, a hunter, a competitive horseman, a broadcaster, and now works as a chief consultant. He's been a guest at the White House during six different presidential administrations, and he even once conducted the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. Above all, though, Rutherford was a racer and a champion. He's one of just nine men to win the Indy 500 three times, and he won in stock cars and sprint cars as well. Longtime Indianapolis 500 broadcaster Howdy Bell says JR has always been a true gentleman.
We had a chief photographer at the Speedway at one time, or a photographer. I'm not sure he was the chief or not. His name was Bud Jones, Bud and Susie Jones. Bud and Susie were going to have a cookout at their house, and Johnny had this bad accident the previous year. And was rehabbing on his own pretty much. He'd been released. And his right arm, he still can't straighten it. It's got a little bit of a 10 to 15 degree angle of in it that he cannot straighten. But we were at Bud and Susie's house for a cookout, and they decided to make some homemade ice cream. And it was not an electric one. This was a hand crank job. It was strawberry ice cream, I remember, because Johnny liked strawberry ice cream, so that was the flavor of the night, flavor du jour, if you will. But anyway, I'm cranking that thing, and I said, boy, this ice cream is getting very hard. You know, it's getting close to being ready. And he says, here, let me crank that thing. He says, I need to work out this arm a little bit, because he was still in his own mind rehabbing it, trying to get back to where he could race again. And, of course, he was very successful after that. But that's just the kind of a guy he is. He's a super nice guy. But when he gets on the racetrack, he's just like everybody else. I'm going to win.
Rutherford was born in Kansas, but his family moved to Texas when he was 12. He became known as Lone Star JR and wore the distinctive star of the Texas state flag on his racing helmet. He saw his first 500-mile race in Indianapolis in 1960, competed in his first 500 in 1963, and won in 74, 76, and 80. Without a doubt, he's one of the legendary figures of his sport. Here's veteran racing commentator Robin Miller on Rutherford's legacy.
In the history of the Speedway, he was one of the most exciting drivers ever. He was one of the most exciting drivers on four wheels. I mean, you should have seen him in a sprint car. I mean, the guy was a sprint car champion, but there are guys that run the bottom of the track, there are guys that run the middle of the track, and there were guys that ran the cushion or ran high like Rutherford. And those are the guys that took the chances and that took your breath away. And John's easily one of the dozen best, I think. He was the essence of what racing was all about. You know, when you're willing to just go for it and damn the consequences, that's what racing's about. That's what guys do. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. It's not supposed to be about thinking about your 401k or, I mean, and he also survived an era where they killed somebody every month.
No doubt about it, Rutherford came up in a rough and tumble era and earned his racing stripes through serious injuries, rotten luck, and a long wait to find a team capable of winning. Not only did he not win the 500 until his 11th start, he didn't finish a race or lead a lap until that victorious 11th Indy appearance. His progress at the Speedway was interrupted in 1966 when he had to miss the 500 with severe injuries suffered in a sprint car race in Ohio a few weeks before practice began. Rutherford, who was the defending national sprint car champion at the time, was hit in the face by a rock on the dirt track at Eldora, lost control of the car, hit the top of the guardrail, flew 20 feet over the top of the guardrail, fell 60 feet into a creek, broke both arms, suffered a severe concussion, and was laid up in the hospital for a month. He had 9 surgeries to repair all the damage. Today, though, he can recall the incident with a sense of humor. He reminisced about it when he appeared on One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan in Indianapolis.
I'm stretched out of the car. You know, you physically can't hold on. The G-force is so great. So I'm in the air, and I'm still looking for the sports writer that captioned the picture in the newspaper. Rutherford waves to the crowd as he leaves the racetrack.
Looking back on it, he figures that incident caused at least a 3-year setback to his career at the Speedway. Did he ever think of giving up?
No. You know, all successful drivers come out of the same mold. Foyt, Parnelli, Mario, you know, everybody that excels, the Unsers, and you know, all of the Andretti's, the key ingredient is desire. You got to have the world's worst case of the want-tos. You got to want to do it so badly.
The breakthrough for Rutherford came in 1974 after he hooked up with Team McLaren. Finally, he had a car capable of winning. But even then, he had to endure hardship. A blown engine on qualifying day forced him to start 25th, or on the inside of the ninth row. But he worked his way to the front and led 122 laps. Late in the race, Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network analyst Freddie Agabagian and anchor Sid Collins had lots of praise for JR.
He's been one of our most outstanding young men as far as furthering the image of automobile racing and manhood is concerned. He's a fabulous young man. He'll do a lot with this win, not only for himself, but for automobile racing in general. And I'm real pleased to see him out there in front. He's a great guy. He's a very courageous guy, by the way, with all the setbacks he's had in the past. Anybody in his right mind that was a little bit weaker would have long time ago left the business. And he's got a lot of guts, I want to tell you that.
I'll tell you something else. As we all know up here in the booth and broadcasting the time trials, a couple of weeks ago when he was bounced back to the 25th spot, had to qualify not for the pole. He was very disappointed, made some protest, but he was up here with Tom Binford, the chief steward, on the second weekend for interviews with us, and they shook hands. There were no hard feelings, and I imagine there could have been a little bit of pouting taking place or something of that nature, but John said, well, you have your job to do, and I have mine. I think they kind of buried any differences they may have had right here in this very same area we're broadcasting from right now.
Moments later, Rutherford had an Indianapolis 500 win to show for his effort. Here's Rutherford with Radio Network pit reporter Lou Palmer from Victory Lane.
John, for a guy who's never led a lap here, you did pretty good today.
Well, thank you. Lou, by golly, that one lap was the only one I wanted to lead, the last one. And I can't say enough for this McLaren crew. They work very hard. We've had some setbacks. We've lost 2 or 3 engines. And we've just had all kinds of trouble, and by golly, it paid off today. I had my doubts when we started so far back, but the way everything worked out is great.
Still today, he recalls the thrill of that first victory.
It's incredible. The adrenaline's still pumping a couple of days later. You know, it's a great sense of accomplishment, number one, because there's only one guy every year that wins that race, and to experience that is incredible.
Rutherford finished second in 1975, won again in 1976, and then absolutely dominated the circuit in 1980, winning the IndyCar Points Championship. Along the way, he sat on the pole for the 500, and oh, he won the race too, driving the famous yellow submarine for Jim Hall.
Number 4, the Pennzoil Chaparral, his hand.
Indianapolis 500 mile race.
Perhaps the most lasting image from that race was Rutherford giving fellow driver Tim Richmond a ride to the pits after the race. Richmond's car stalled on the track. Rutherford points out Lady Luck was on his side from the very beginning in 1980.
It was nearly time to start thinking about getting in the car and getting ready. And I felt this something in my hair, and I reached up and kind of flicked my hair and looked on my shoulder, and there was a huge orange and black spotted ladybug. She was crawling in circles on my shoulder. And I told Jim and Steve, I said, tell the rest of these cats to load up and go home. We just won this thing. I've had that since 1970 as my good luck charm.
Oh, really? Okay.
Used to buy the little bitty plastic ones that looked just like a real ladybug, and the guys would glue one to the center of the steering wheel.
That would turn out to be Rutherford's final win at the Speedway. He retired in 1994, taking a final lap on a car borrowed from A.J. Foyt, the same car, in fact, in which Foyt had taken his final farewell lap the year before. Rutherford's legacy goes well beyond the track. He was a trendsetter in public relations as well, representing the sport in a dignified manner for the media and the public. Once again, here's Robin Miller.
John was one of the first guys that really paid attention to PR. He remembered people's names. He always had time for everybody, fans and media. I'd like to see some of these kids today follow him and Mario around for a couple days because they could learn a lot from him about how to deal with press and how to deal with the public. And I think the thing that's cool about JR is he's like Mario. He never forgot where he came from. You know, he still respects those guys that gave him his first ride in a modified in a sprint car, and he still likes, you know, he drives the pace car at the IndyCar races. He still likes being involved. It's his life.
Ultimately, Johnny Rutherford was and is one of racing's greatest ambassadors. Here's former radio voice of the 500, Paul Page, with a final word.
I think he recognized first what a champion needed to be in the new era. And he followed that route of making a lot of public appearances, always being available to the public, showing, again, great kindness to anybody he knew. I've been a guest in his home any number of times, and John is funny. You get him out, you get him on the road, and you look at him and you say, you know, there's a champion. There's a guy who thinks like a champion. He treats the public the way a champion should. Mario does the same thing. Johnny is just one good human being.
Coming up, a look at some of the famous names outside of racing who've taken part in the festivities at the Speedway. This is the History of the 500. This is the History of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. The Indianapolis 500 has made stars of many throughout its history, but the Speedway has also been graced by many stars from outside the world of racing. Just south of the pagoda at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, there's a press building. In the various rooms in that press building, media center, cafeteria, there are photographs, big photographs, not just of drivers, but of celebrities from years gone by. There are photographs of Martin and Lewis clowning around in a race car in the early 50s, and a photo of Clark Gable holding a race day program. A promotional video by the track features some more modern celebrities. Rap star Ludacris.
Over 300 million households watching. I got to be a part of it. Anytime cars are going over 200 miles an hour, I'm here.
Gene Simmons from Kiss and actor Russell Crowe.
We are here at Hallowed Ground. This is the Indy 500. You wish you were here. I am.
I'll tell you, this is the cleanest, most pretty looking racetrack I've ever seen in my life.
And boxing legend Muhammad Ali.
This is a big event. I've never saw so many people.
In 2003, not one but two former presidents attended the Indianapolis 500, Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush.
Big moment in my life. I thought I'd seen everything. I thought I've experienced every thrill, but this one is top.
In 1979, Gerald R. Ford became the first former U.S. president to attend the greatest spectacle in racing. Here's his chat with the late IMS Radio Network reporter Bob Forbes.
Mr. President, welcome, of course, to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and to the millions of people who are listening today.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's been a great thrill for me to come out here to Indianapolis and to see firsthand all the things that make this one of the great sporting spectaculars of the year. Actually, it's a thrill to see it.
Have you seen the Speedway before today, sir?
I never have, and I've seen it on television, heard it on radio, read about it, but there's nothing like being here in person and seeing the cars on the track, talking with the drivers, going to the pits. Well, it's part of the ball game, and when you're here, you're part of it.
I don't know if you had anything to do with the weather, but you've done a great job there.
Well, I woke up this morning about 3:30 a.m. and the rain was just coming down like a downpour. I woke up at 6 and the clouds were moving out. The sun came up about 7 and it's beautiful.
Mr. President, thank you for taking time. We hope you see a very fast and a safe race and enjoy your stay here, sir.
It's a great pleasure and a privilege. Congratulations to everybody.
That same year, Ford became the first U.S. president to serve as Grand Marshal of the 500 Festival Parade, held on the streets of downtown Indianapolis the day before the race. Past Grand Marshals of the parade have included Indianapolis sports icons Peyton Manning and Larry Bird, as well as David Hasselhoff and, well, Mickey Mouse. Sometimes celebrities who show up at the 500 have a job to do, drive the pace car. Morgan Freeman did it.
Look in my rearview mirror, I have 33 drivers waiting for me.
Lance Armstrong had that duty too.
It'll be a rush driving around with 250,000 people. You know, the opening lap, that's probably when they're as loud as they could be, just screaming for their favorite driver.
Lance Armstrong off of turn number 4 will pull off of the track. The green flag waves and we're underway.
And so did Good Morning America's Robin Roberts.
I've never been there for the actual, I've always been there for the lead up. Working at the Worldwide Leader, you have to go to everything. And I remember going to a couple of the pre-events, but I've never been there for the whole kit and caboodle. I have to say, though, when they first contacted me, I was like, can I think about it? And then I was, because I won the Driver's Ed Award in 10th grade. You know, I'm 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock on the wheel. Very cautious driver. And then I'm like, what am I thinking about? Who wouldn't want to do this?
The 2010 500 saw a visit from arguably one of the biggest stars to ever attend the greatest spectacle in racing. He had a good seat, too.
The field of 33 on the front straight for the start of the 94th running of the greatest spectacle in racing. Will we see Elio go into the four-time winner's club? Jack Nicholson waves the green flag, and we're underway.
Of course, late-night talk show host and Hoosier native David Letterman has attended the race in recent years as a team owner. He saw one of his drivers, Buddy Rice, win the race in 2004.
They will roll down this front straightaway for the final time. They will complete 180 laps. Buddy Rice from Phoenix, Arizona, wins from the pole position. He is the winner of the 88th Indianapolis 500-mile race. As flashbulbs light up the yard of bricks, Buddy Rice has won the Indy 500. Let's go downstairs to Kim Morris.
The rain falls and David Letterman watches. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Nice job.
You said the rain made no difference at all. Were you convinced he was going to win anyway?
Oh, he was so strong, for heaven's sakes. And he...
he blows a kiss.
He led so effortlessly. And then after that one pit stop, he comes out in 16th. And your heart sinks a little bit. But Buddy's heart didn't sink at all. And he just kept gnawing at it, and running everybody down. The car was the strongest one in the field all day. I mean, it demonstrated that. Opened up the early lead, and then we sit out for an hour and a half for rain. Nothing fazed him, nothing fazed the car. I mean, it was bound to happen. You know, 200 laps, 400 laps, I think it's still Buddy.
What does it feel like to win at Indy?
Well, it's just nuts. I don't belong here, for heaven's sakes. What am I doing here?
You're winning!
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
But back in 1971, he was a reporter for ABC Television. He was so new that race announcer Jim McKay misidentified him.
Chris Economaki has Mario Andretti.
Mario, what happened?
Well, obviously, there was some oil. I think that was spilled by Krisilov's car. And when we arrived on the scene, Jonkoff spun in front of me, hit the wall, and ricocheted into my path. And I was trying to kind of pinch it down close so I won't get into them, but I had nothing I could do.
What about the traffic? The faster cars coming up with the slower ones now.
Well, that's normal pace of the race. I mean, this you see everywhere. That's no particular problem.
Thank you very much. Mario Andretti out of the 1971 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Okay, the green flag is out there racing again. I may have said that was Chris Economaki doing the interview. It was actually Dave Letterman.
Another talk show host actually drove an Indy car during a test run. Johnny Carson, host of The Tonight Show, shared footage with his audience from a ride he took around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 1967.
Now, this is out at Indianapolis. Remember one year they had that ramjet engine, which they since disqualified. They wouldn't let you use it. So we went out and took a couple of turns around the track and got up to 176 miles an hour.
And we've seen another small screen celebrity behind the wheel of late, a small screen celebrity who's also happened to win 3 Indianapolis 500-mile races.
After 10 weeks of competition, the winners and new champions of Dancing with the Stars are...
Elio Castroneves, also well known for his big win on Dancing with the Stars. Dance partner Julianne Hough was given the opportunity to sing the national anthem at the Indy 500 in 2008. She joined a list of performers that included Jessica Andrews, Sandy Patty, members of the United States Armed Forces, Jessica Simpson, Steven Tyler. The latter caused more than a little bit of controversy when he decided to change the lyrics of the Star Spangled Banner when he performed the anthem back in 2001.
Indianapolis 500!
Mr. Tyler has not been asked back for return engagement after that one. The anthem had been sung on numerous occasions by a Dale, Indiana native, the woman who played Mrs. Brady, Florence Henderson. These days, she sings God Bless America, and she's become one of those celebrities that we absolutely expect to see each and every year. Mrs. Brady will sing, Ruth Buzzy from Laugh-In will ride in the parade, and since 1972, Jim Nabors has sung Back Home Again in Indiana just before the command to start engines. He's missed just a few since then due to scheduling conflicts and illness. Even though he's better known for sitcom roles he created in the 60s, for one day every year, Jim Nabors, Gomer Pyle, is an A-lister in every Hoosier heart.
Back home again in Indiana, and it seems that I can see the gleaming candlelight still burning bright through the sycamores for me. The new mown hay sends out its fragrance through the fields I used to roam. When I dream about the moonlight on the Wabash, how I long for my Indiana home.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of The History of the 500. In our next episode, it's on to the 1980s, during which a second driver joined the four-time winners club, and three others became three-time winners. I'm Steve Simpson.